started in 2006 in Chicago. And by now we have chapters around the country, in the United States, in New York, in Boston, in Philadelphia, in Toronto, in Princeton, but also in Thessaloniki in Greece. And we're getting started here in Frankfurt and also in London. We have members who want to get Platypus started.
And New Delhi.
And New Delhi, of course, yeah. In India. And in Maastricht, in Holland. So, I mean, we're going to talk in our presentation. We're going to give you guys an overview of what like, the group is about and by like, fleshing out the more recent histories of like the German left and of the US left. And we're going to go into historical points to like give an idea of like what problems we tackle in the work of our group. And like something that should be mentioned about this event, that this is a little bit atypical for what Platypus does, because usually we do events with different speakers and different people who don't share the same view. So we put them together on a panel, provide them with questions, and we want to provoke a discussion that otherwise wouldn't happen, to provoke self-reflection and to actually get a discussion and a talk running among different tendencies of the left that would otherwise not speak to each other. So the order of this talk is going to be Haseeb Ahmed is going to start. He is an artist, and he currently works and studies at the Van Eyck Academy in Maastricht. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about like a few problems of the German left and how we think that Platypus speaks to the present conditions in Germany. Then after that, Watson is going to dive into a more historical problem, and we'll talk about the kind of approach of history and how that is related, and you'll take up a historical figure. And following that, Pam Nogales, who's at the New York University, she will talk about the reflection in what way the new left related to the old left. We hope to be done with that with our presentations in about 45 minutes, and then we can have an open conversation we can have questions from you guys and have an open talk. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I'll begin. As I just said, I'm Haseeb Ahmed, and recently relocated to Maastricht, where I'm a researcher in fine arts at the Jan van Eyck Academy, and where we've just started a kind of chapter activities. Maastricht, I guess, is kind of appropriate in one way, maybe only, which is that Marx did spend 3 whole weeks in Maastricht writing Capital at his uncle's house. But before this, I was living and studying in Boston, where I also helped start the Boston chapter of Platypus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But before that, you know, I was a founding member of Platypus back in 2006 in Chicago, started at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. But yeah, just thanks everyone for attending. It's a pleasure to be presenting here in Frankfurt. It's not really lost on me that, you know, of course, Frankfurt, and we're sitting here in Frankfurt School, or home of Adorno, Horkheimer, Benjamin, and more. And you know, I've heard also that Postone, right, wrote part of his book, Time, Labor, and Social Domination here. So yeah, it's a real pleasure. So I'd like to just provide a kind of like sense of what Platypus is, its history, and how it's developed over the years, its theory and practice through various engagements. So what brought Platypus into existence in 2006? It's been 5 years. It grew out of the very specific historical and geographic context of the US in 2006. Like our aim has always been to throw the kind of historical conditions of the present into relief, and this is because the history of the left is an international one. We are students of this international left. So dates like 1848, 1917, 1968, and perhaps even more problematically, 1989, and into the present, we would say were all world historical events. The totality of capitalism that we live in necessitates a totalized theory and practice that can overcome capitalism. It's our responsibility as leftists to pose critiques of left movements elsewhere in the world, and we in Platypus have done this over and over again with critiques of the Naxalites in India, the Green Movement in Iran, and this includes a reason for translating and publishing the anti-Deutsch text, Israel and Communism, and more. The intention is not to identify with these various formations we engage in, but rather to contextualize their practice as a symptom of the self-destruction of the international left. Every group manifests this problem by the fact that it is part of the international left. So it manifests this symptom in some kind of way. Following Kolakowski, which I think Jerzy will also be discussing in his presentation, we would say the history of humanity lies in the clarification of the Marxist conception of freedom. Today, the rhetoric of freedom, future of humanity lies in the clarification of Marxist conception of freedom. Today, the rhetoric of freedom belongs to the right. The history of the left is a history of its failure to realize itself in crucial junctions throughout world history. One of the key texts that we read and continue to read in our reading groups in every chapter is Rosa Luxemburg's writings on imperialism as an intervention into the Second International towards the attempt to make a world revolutionary moment, the failure of which resulted in World War I. The Russian Revolution, the failed German Revolution in 1917 and 1918 were indeed world historical events. A central question through which the Marxian left and the Second International formed a coherent ideology revolved around the question of imperialism. When we read Rosa Luxemburg, we consider it as it was in conversation with Lenin, who in 1916, the eve of the Russian Revolution, wrote Imperialism, the highest age of capitalism. In our first ever public event in Chicago, 2006, it was called Imperialism, What Is It and Why Should We Be Against It? Still young, we organized this event with great enthusiasm. It was our aim to host the conversation, a conversation we saw not happening anywhere else among various fragments of the left, or what was left of the left. Invited was Adam Turrell, a member of the International Socialist Organization, one of the largest groups in the US. Nick Kreitman, a leader of the newly resurrected Students for Democratic Society, which subsequently fell apart along the same lines as the old SDS of 68. Danny Postel, a well-known activist and writer. Kevin Anderson of News and Letters, an old Marxist humanist tendency in the States, which has since undergone a number of splits, and our own Chris Catrone, one of our main pedagogues and current president of the group. We had invited the Spartacists League, an international, though sectarian Trotskyist group. However, they refused our invitation, but came out in force to protest our very first event with pamphlets in hand, accusing us of being overly academic, or in their words, an academic claptrap, meaning like self-congratulatory, kind of group. This accusation was due to the sectarian tactics that they'd held over from the 1930s. They continued as if nothing has changed. So one thing that Pam Nogales, one of our co-presenters here, reported about the first event was that at the end of the Bush presidency and at the height of the US war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we recognized to those students turning out en masse, they were being given signs by various leftist groups, organizations who had organized, tailed after the protests and demos. These slogans, troops out now, done with American capitalism, destroy American fascism, all expressed a sense of urgency about the present. Behind the slogans, however, were both a deep sense of confusion as to what exactly should be done and a suspension of disbelief of the absolutely irrelevant character of the radical left. Our event asked various leftists to answer the question, what is imperialism, and what lies at the core of anti-imperialist politics? The answers that followed clearly presented the ideological confusion hidden away by the exclamation points on the protest placards. The event was organized in order to capture the sense of confusion behind the slogans of the American left. It was an attempt to capture, objectify this uncertainty in order to grapple with it head-on, to deal with it, to confront it, in order to polemicize it, and make it an object of concern to be grappled with. In the symposium, the central problem emerged around the principle of support for any resistance to U.S. imperialism, whatever its political tendency. In the midst of the ultimatum of solidarity posed by many left groups at the time, what we insisted to ask, what if you have no sides to choose from within the conflict? So, or rather, like, what if the sides that are presented to you are both, that you have to choose from are both of the right? So U.S. imperialism or the Iraqi insurgency, which is often of religious character. This lack of options in the world and the denial of this fact by left groups in the U.S. and elsewhere is the very real character of the death of the left. This question of support for right-wing resistance remains a major point of contention with left formations around the world. In the panel, we also saw various apologies for the Democratic Party by leftists. We saw leftists attempting to present the war as a crisis, as if crisis itself can produce a popular left. Some panelists like Kevin Anderson and Chris Catrone did critique the logic that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and we arrived at a point which was contentious but proven itself to be true over and over. The left support for leaders like Ahmadinejad and Chavez are in fact the double side of capitalism and not necessarily emancipatory in their opposition to it, although they oppose U.S. hegemony. Which, to be clear, we in Platypus also oppose. Since then, we have organized a number of panels, with each presenting and yielding a particular symptomology of the left. A panel called What is a Movement? Laid out the distinction between unions and organized left politics and the necessity for their interdependence between unions and organized left. It included union leaders, immigration rights organizers, student activists, along with Platypus representative Richard Rubin. A panel on ideology and the student movement identified the persistence of the problem of leadership within organizations, or rather, the refusal to have leadership or to articulate an ideology that is often present nonetheless. For instance, in types of informal leadership, the kind of de facto leadership that takes hold in a lot of these student groups where a central group of friends will just make all of the decisions, but they never take any kind of official position from which they can be held accountable for those decisions. Platypus remains a hierarchical organization as a means to an end of eventually reconstituting an international and emancipatory left politics. So what that means by hierarchical is that we have a type of structure which includes regional coordination, especially now that we've expanded throughout the globe. We have to have steady lines of communication. We have working groups from which we can share knowledge and practical experience in organizing various types of panels. We also, for our paper, which is there, we have an editorial board with chief editors, proofreaders, all of these things, which is necessary to do the type of practical work that our theory kind of elicits. Over the years, we have grown substantially as an organization and intellectually attracting members who brought with them the memories of various milieus that they had been politicized in. Moreover, our central activities now include a monthly publication that extends the conversation we host on the left. So, for example, again, the ISF article, Israel, Communism in Israel, was published alongside an interview we conducted with Noam Chomsky. We host reading groups with a syllabus that we have developed over the last 5 years. For me, the syllabus itself is one of our greatest accomplishments, as it manages to condense a problematic and extensive history of art into a set of very concise readings. So we are happy to be presenting to you here in Frankfurt to inaugurate our Frankfurt chapter, which Jezsa will be chapter head. And I hope you'll join in the coming days, the reading group and other activities we organize with other groups here in Frankfurt. I think they'll be also doing the primary reading group, which is which is dealing explicitly with the history of the left. So, yeah, thank you.
So, I'm going to dive into the problems of that I think that the German left is facing. And when I first written my presentation, it covered more of some points of Moshe Pistone, which due to the amount of time we have available, I had to cut down a little bit. But some points I will address, I think, will probably be somewhat available in the audience, like certain discussions that took place in the last years, and especially in Germany. So, Platypus as an organization was founded in 2006 in Chicago. It is important to keep in mind the context of its foundation and the political landscape in which it took place, because in many ways it understood itself to be a response to the character of the left that revealed itself in that moment. 2006 was President Bush's second term in the midst of the Iraq War, which caused ongoing protests throughout the country and internationally. On campuses, young people would get politicized around the issue of the war and bound up with the politics of anti-imperialism. Platypus founding members consisted of students of the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, who quickly became dissatisfied with the one-sided approaches which were provided to confront the situation. In this context, the Marx scholar Moshe Pistone and his critique of the anti-war movement resonated powerfully and raised the question to what extent the left in the 2000s was actually able to have any sort of impact on the conditions it attacked. It raised the problem of its adequacy to the present. It expressed a deep inability to reflect on the changed conditions which the world underwent in the past decades. The simple repetition of previous forms of politics made the question of confusion and helplessness of the left acute. I want to address an important point right away that can cause a lot of confusion and indeed has caused this in the past. A common understanding that German leftists have, who encountered our group in the United States, is that Platypus is being thought of as an esoteric and delayed offshoot of the anti-Deutsch tendency which stirred up in the German left in the early 2000s. Germans I talk to often think that Platypus and its critique of one-sided alignments with supposed anti-imperialist forces, as well as a deep appreciation of Pistone's analysis of Marx, is something that the German left already struggled with and supposedly successfully overcame. However, I want to warn against such misappropriation and want to argue for the recognition of a deeper problem that is being addressed by Platypus in its political practice. To conceive the critique of the anti-war movement simply as a problematization of anti-imperialist politics, for its true or supposed anti-Semitic character, or even for its problematic forms of anti-capitalism, misses an important point that I find not sufficiently raised by the German left. Or to put it more bluntly, that points to a deeper problem of the German left itself. In trying to present Platypus as a project, I want to emphasize the similarities of both the US and the German left, despite its seemingly opposed character. So especially when you take like the conversations which took place around the anti-war protests, so you had like on the American left, it was dominated by let's say, by the discourse of anti-imperialism. So, I mean, something that Hasib just mentioned. So there were, for example, there were people which went to demos, and they, by those different socialist organizations, they were just given signs, you know, where they said, you know, like, a strike, you know, a strike to U.S. imperialism is like a win for the workers, and like that any type of politics that conceives itself as being socialist is necessary, will like have an alignment with like the reactionary forces in Iraq. And then on the other side, you have like the discussions here, which were, I would say, in that moment, were shaped by the critique of those kind of politics. So you have the anti-Deutsch with like a, let's say more with an alignment with the U.S. government and also with the Israeli politics. So despite those like seeming contradictions, I think there's like an important similarity. And this will help to understand why we think of our project as raising questions of international importance, of the global character of the left today, that do not stay confined to the particular political context of the United States. The question would be not as much how similar problems of the left in Germany could be resolved by practices developed in the US, but rather would raise the question of the absence of the left as an international force. How does this absence affect the disparate lefts around the world, and what does it mean to pose this question this way? It would be the question how the absence of the possibility of real politics impacts the self-understanding of people who proclaim to be interested in the project of emancipation. This means not only categorizing symptoms that we encounter into a framework that derives from the experiences gained through the contestation of the American left, but also an impact on the very framework itself. It raises the question of self-recognition. To put it more concretely, the problems of the German left can be revelatory to problems of the US left in a way that could not be conceived before, and vice versa. But more importantly, it could transform the way we understand the left and how the left understands itself. The absence or presence of phenomena can actually let us think not only how histories of the left in different regions, but actually the history of the left manifests itself today. The attempt is to take those problems seriously and reflect on what they point towards, not simply to critique them abstractly or to ignore them in their particularity. Many of you might be confused why we hold on to this distinction between left and right. And indeed, the character of this distinction seems to be problematic in the present. If the left is dead, as we proclaim, that means only the right prevails. How then can any distinction between left and right make any sense for us today? Precisely because we retain from succumbing to this impoverished reality. We raise history to make it speak to the present, to call it out on its imagination of possibility for a better future. We follow Leszek Kolakowski on how the category of the left holds in tension the reality of the moment and the drive for its negation. In his essay, The Concept of the Left, he defines the left not as a sociological category, by belonging to a class, as upholding values or phrases, but at the level of ideas, not yet realized. Not society is divided between left and right, but thinking. For Kolakowski, the left is a force that strives to change society into how it ought to be. It understands itself as being a part of the historical development, being grounded in and not outside of it, but also as being the decisive factor for pushing reality forwards by negating and constantly contesting it. As he puts it, why is a utopia a condition of all revolutionary moments? Because much historical experience tells us that goals unattainable now will never be reached unless they are articulated when those goals are still unattainable. It may well be that the impossible at a given moment can become possible only by being stated at a time when it is impossible. The existence of a utopia as a utopia is the necessity, is the necessary prerequisite for its eventually ceasing to be a utopia. Unquote. It is the right, he claims, that is affirmative of the existing order. It knows nothing but tactics. It willingly capitulates to the present and wants to solidify it. Therefore, it also wants to eliminate the very distinction between left and right. The work to define, apply, and distinguish between these categories belongs to the left itself. It is in this sense, it is indicative of the false left today, that it willingly gives up the definition that is so crucial for its self-understanding. The readiness in which it gives up the distinction between left and right expresses the loss of its utopian imagination. It realizes this distinction as problematic, but instead to struggle for its meaning, it succumbs to the problem and to the confusion it faces. This is the problematic character of post-politics or a post-left self-understanding. It begs the question of its transformative character, of how it upholds the strive for changing reality. The discussions that took place on the German left in the past decade were important to raise the bankruptcy of present-day politics. It indeed struggled with fetishistic and concretistic forms of anti-capitalism that have a deeply regressive character. What this debate, however, failed to address is the very root of the problem, what Pistone calls helplessness, or a severe frustration of the faculty of the action, of the faculty of action in the modern world. In other words, misrecognition of the forms of capital and the abstract character of its domination are deeply related to the inability to change the world. What this means is that the problem can't be merely solved in the realm of thought. It is not simply because of flaws in the concept or insufficiency of theory. Rather, it relates to the situation of the powerlessness that the left faces today. Taking helplessness seriously as the very obstacle for emancipatory change cannot only result in tactical reconsiderations and theoretical adjustments. It must substantially be reflected in the aims of political praxis and the acknowledgement of the poverty of the possibility for thought today. It is in this sense we understand Marx's famous quote that one can only understand the world to the extent to which one can change it. Therefore, if we are not able to transform the world, we can hardly claim to understand it correctly. By drawing the attention to the distorted and disempowered state of the present-day left, we want to raise it to the level of importance. We claim the left is dead because our aim is to make this character apparent and available for reflection. We do not succumb to this helplessness by ignoring or internalizing it, like many do on the left today. The common attitude on both sides of the Atlantic of simply carrying on the fight, of growing any kind of movement that seeks to make radical break with capital, cannot explain to what extent the present looks more prosperous than the past. Simply trying to politicize people to grow the subculture or organize for social justice does not take into account how and why this is supposed to stop the left from disintegrating. These movement politics are trapped in the immediacy of the situation. An example of this approach to politics is the scene character of the German left. Politicization and mobilization as the prime concern of one's political praxis usually fail to explain to what end people are politicized in the first place. I myself experienced this when I became politicized in my late teens in Western Germany. The initial recognition of a systematic flaw in society led me to participate more and more in what I would call scene activities, like rallies, study circles, and parties. The initial excitement and shared suspicion about society and capitalism led me to identify myself with a scene that aims for the overcoming of those conditions. Whole identities are built around this notion of resisting the everyday life and call into question the daily routine. The imagination employed is of people living outside of society, of creating alternative realities in Freiräume that promise the absence of societal constraints. Within the course of 1 or 2 years, my friends and I became increasingly disenchanted with the lack of conceptual clarity and the confusion as to what to do and the uselessness of our political practice. More and more, we became a study circle and tried to gain clarity through the theoretical reflection. We started to organize panels and reading groups. Hardly could this praxis address the inability to have any impact on the world we were addressing by our critique. Overall, almost of the people that I worked with a few years ago became depoliticized or political opportunists. Especially the latter makes the question of helplessness acute. It was no betrayal on the part of my friends, rather the recognition that to achieve any influence it is necessary to succumb to present conditions and systematic constraints. For them, only two options existed, both of which were defeats. To capitulate to repetition, to the reenactment of the same practices over and over again, despite the recognition that this would not have any transformative impact. In other words, what is clinically described as insanity. Or giving up the aim to change systematic constraints that capital itself creates. Both are an expression of helplessness, but both concede to it. By suppressing the feeling of helplessness, both actually carry it out, albeit unconsciously. This is what Platypus tries to address by its political praxis. We want to make the left recognize its dead character, its inability to transform society. To do so, we organize panels and fora in which we seek to make the current state of the left apparent. We think that its current impasse can only be overcome by recognizing how the present is prefigured by past attempts to change the world. The extent in which one is confronted by a reality that was not brought about without our own contribution, it is conceived as a foreign, inaccessible force that controls our present. History, in that view, seems to be an unfolding of necessity. We try to call this into question. In order to grasp the possibilities of today, we have to come to terms with the possibilities of the past. They are failures only to the extent that they are acknowledged as entailing a potential that has not been realized. This, we claim, could allow to really learn from the past. It would allow to conceive of the past as a utopian demand on the present, as a left yet to be redeemed. We try to hold in tension the self-understanding of those who tried with the tragic outcomes of their failures. We cannot succumb to the latter. We cannot internalize defeat, but rather have to redeem it. We exclaim, long live the left.
Max Horkheimer on 1917. Anyone who has the eyes to see will view events in Russia as the continuing attempt to overcome this terrible social injustice. At the very least, he will ask with a throbbing heart whether it is still underway. The transitional program of Trotsky is an important text for Platypus. It was in many ways a bridge. Its critique of the Stalinized left points to the possibility of a new left, while its affirmation of the need for revolution in the core capitalist countries continues the hope, which Horkheimer recognized, of the legacy of 1917 as the only revolution, successful workers' revolution, that became a world historical event. Written as the Second World War was looming on the horizon, it expressed the hope that just as the First World War had in its aftermath opened the way for revolution, that the Second World War would do the same. While a reaction to Stalinism, the viewing of 1917 as the forever accomplished, the transitional program nevertheless saw that there was a legacy of 1917 that could be continued, and saw itself as the manifesto for a new revolution, as a new practical program for advancing the cause of socialism. Trotsky was not merely reflecting on theory. He was exercising, in a way that may seem very obscure today, leadership of the Fourth International. The long fight of the 1920s and 30s against Stalinist backstabbing, Stalinist regression, Stalinist lies, and fascists had steadily diminished the prospects for any such reformation of the left. But despite this history, Trotsky allowed himself a glimmer of hope. The Party of Lenin would have its successors in the Fourth International. Looking back some 70 years later, we see that the Second World War did no such thing. It heralded a period of worldwide regression, rather than one of revolutionary unrest. Trotsky's optimism may have been misplaced. When the unrest of the 1960s rolled around, Trotskyism was again not ready. As much as the very idea of forming a new left was indebted to Trotsky, the new left was deeply skeptical about Trotsky and Trotskyism, and ultimately many of its members turned to Maoism, choosing to respond to Stalinism by becoming more Stalinist than Stalin. The new left was the best opportunity for a recreation of the left, but it diminished into mindless violence or political or simply mainstream politics. The transitional program remains, therefore, a path not taken. The 100 splinters of Trotskyism around the world lack the ability to be the movement envisioned by Trotsky. This lack is not for lacking politicization or effort or a workable theory. Rather, something about conditions today makes imagining a revived Trotskyism very, very deeply problematic. This history is not one of betrayal, but of the actions of the left over history, as making it very difficult to continue. Now, back to 1917, which we've had the Horkheimer quote about. It's a moment that Trotsky constantly refers to, even as he is, even with its contentious legacy. It represents the first successful workers' uprising, the only truly world historical significance event of the left. After 1917, revolution would never be the same. Key to 1917 for Trotsky was the question of leadership. And this is not leadership in the sense of giving orders, but rather a sort of intellectual leadership. Lenin, of course, takes time to write Stay in Revolution on the eve of the revolution. Not to exercise leadership, not by ordering people around, but by convincing them. And this is a tradition that Trotsky, with the transitional program, seeks to continue. He seeks to convince people that his way is the right way, and therefore they should choose to join his movement that is practically working and forming the world. It's this kind of intellectual vanguardism that makes Trotsky more than just a thinker. His thought is for the purpose of guiding people to action. The time of the transitional program was one of an urgent problem. Whether you were going to be on the left, a Stalinist or a Trotskyist, this decision would determine where you marched. It would determine what your positions were on 100 other issues. It would determine who your friends were. Today, there is no such urgency, and therefore, we can look back on Trotskyism and Stalinism as without the urgency that pervaded it, and rather as in a more analytical way, as the question of form as two different kinds of left. And this is a opportunity that lets us consider the question of what does this legacy mean for us today? How does this path not taken haunt us? How does the fact that it wasn't taken condition the times that we now live in and the prospects for revolution today? This is not a complete discussion of the transitional program at all. It's just simply indicating the ways in which we'll want to situate any discussion of it. And this is a discussion that we do have internally. It is a text that we read inside and we talk about from this perspective. And it's also try and link this to our questions of the left today.
Platypus exists today as a practice, as an attempt to politicize the confusion and helplessness lurking behind thought and action on the left today. We strive to make this confusion palpable because, as we wrote in our statement of purpose from 2007, if the left is to change the world, it must first transform itself. Our activities involve hosting the conversation on the left by inviting our participants to reflect on their political practice in relationship to their organizational goals and the adequacy of this relationship. Platypus started as a reading group in the School of the Art Institute of Chicago during the summer of 2006, We read the New Left Reader, a compilation of texts that help us understand the concerns of the 60s New Left. The questions these initial readings posed led us to continue the reading group well into the fall and pushed us to start a practice of public panels, a monthly newspaper, and weekly informal discussions. We therefore became an organization in order to pursue, through an ongoing practice, the answers to our concerns about the current state of the left. These concerns could not be answered via the text because the absence of emancipatory politics is a living problem. It is a problem of the present. Therefore, we needed to grapple with this problem, that is the problem of political impasse in our practice. The texts that we chose today to carry us through the panels are the tools to help us present the project. These texts we read very carefully in the early part of the reading group, so all of us have been through the reading group as a practice in our development as members of the group. These texts have helped and continue to help clarify to others, but also to ourselves, why something like Platypus can exist, why we would want it to exist, and why it may need to exist today. Today, Platypus as an organization has a presence through chapters that Yezha mentioned. However, the questions in regards to the means of our projects are far from resolved, that is, how to adequately respond to the present. Rather, these questions are constitutive of our practice, that is, the problems of how to constitute a political practice that addresses the impasse of the present. This is the driving concern of our project. In the activities that we organize, in the work that we do, and in the chapters that we build, we try to return to the point of origin of the organization. The left is dead, long live the left. That is, that the left as we know it has become an obstacle to the formation of emancipatory politics, but long live the project of freedom the left once felt responsible to, but was never able to fully live up to, and one that we recognize is absent on the currently existing left. So I took a text from C. Wright Mills, who is an American sociologist, and he wrote a text called The Letter to the New Left, in his attempt to say, okay, well, this new generation of leftists, what are their tasks in the present? But before, I wanted to quote Horkheimer from the same text that Watson quoted. So it's a brief quote. This text was from 1926. It is well known that the bourgeoisie can discuss anything that is part of its strength. Generally speaking, it grants freedom of thought. Only where thought takes on a form which directly leads to practice, where it becomes unscientific in the academic sphere, things stop being cozy. Mere skepticism essentially means that theory remains just that. The opposite of such skepticism is neither optimism nor dogma, but proletarian practice. Should socialism be improbable, it will require an all the more desperate determination to make it come true. So perhaps what is most tragic about the new left of the 1960s and 70s is that while it recognized that leftist politics had reached a profound impasse, it yielded very little in terms of ideological clarification. In the American left, this problem often manifested itself as an intense distaste for ideas and reflection on political action, a legacy that is all too present. At their worst, the proponents of these politics pushed blindly against barriers they did not seek to understand, and in this way naturalized the old historical defeats of the early 20th century. To what extent something else was possible is up for debate today. However, we, in this moment, cannot afford not to ask ourselves the difficult questions about our present impasse and questions about our political practice. Not unlike the late 1950s, what students today find most compelling in Marx is what among the existing left is fraught with great ideological confusion, the possibility of historical transformation. Crises are no longer opportunities for political mobilization, but just reaffirm how powerless the left is, even in the face of economic collapse. Presently, the right is much more effective at organizing in times of social discontent and holds the monopoly on the rhetoric of freedom, once the battle cry of the left. We have reached a historical impasse of great political consequence. In the face of this degeneration, how do we assess whether or not any self-purported left, either by carrying on with the political struggle or by returning to the legacy of socialist thought, is actually working towards social revolution? Writing during the Cold War era, C. Wright Mills was plagued by a sense that both the right and the left had become obstacles to transformative possibilities. As a critic of the left, Mills leaves much to be admired, and it is through this framework that his letter to the New Left of 1959 can speak to us today. In the 1960s, the New Left tasked itself with overcoming the political impossibilities facing the old left of the 20s and 30s. So it understood these in the following way. The problem of the subject of revolution, who is to make the revolution, that of political organization in the form of anti-authoritarian politics, and the last of the Stalinist optimism of affirming the already established, already existing socialism. So these three problems were what the New Left were responding to. C. Wright Mills, supporter of the New Left, called on this generation of New Leftists to surpass the obstacles of the old left in their practice in order so as to break through the ossified barriers to historical transformation. The substance of Mills' letters to the New Left is his proclamation that both Stalinism and the end of ideology thesis were two sides of the same coin, that is, they were part of the same problem. The blind optimism of Stalinism had turned Marxist politics from a critical into an affirmative practice. So he says, pessimism is permitted, but only episodically, and only within the context of the big optimism. On the other side of the political spectrum, the end of ideology thesis was a mechanical reaction, not a creative response to the ideology of Stalinism. Although at first glance, this may have looked like a battle between the historical optimism of the left, so Stalinism, versus the historical pessimism of the right, so the end of ideology, both, he argued, were expressions of the end of political reflection. And thus, I would say, in the spirit of Jerzy's presentation, a move to the right. It is this recognition that drives him to underline the role of the intelligentsia. And here one may add a word of caution, because Mill's prescription, although originating from a careful assessment of his political moment, could lend itself to vulgar sociological empiricism. So by the virtue of being intellectuals, that the intellectuals hold the key to revolution. So I don't think that's what he's saying. So for Mills, the intelligentsia could play a critical role insofar as it was able to push for political reflection and clarification, not because they were members of a particular social stratum. In other words, the intelligentsia was only potentially revolutionary. Its role is distinct and historically specific. Because both Stalinism and the end of ideology perpetuated a political response to the present in which the real questions are not even raised, maybe the intelligentsia could provide a lens through which the left could return to these pressing questions. Maybe. According to Mills, the left had become an obstacle to itself by losing its grip on the relationship between ideology and political practice. And it is this assessment that leads him to the formulation that the working class had ceased to be a transformative historical force. He wrote, "The clinging mightily to the working class as the historical agency is a historically specific idea that has been turned into an ahistorical and unspecific hope." Hence the label labor metaphysics. He characterized this problem as part of the legacy of Victorian Marxism, a perspective that held steadfast to the working class as the lever to revolution long after the workers' movement had ceased to work toward this goal. It's important, however, that Mills recognizes this crisis as the result of the growing chasm, the growing distance between Marxism as a radical political ideology and the workers' movement. For Mills, the crisis could only be addressed by making this rupture explicit as the political problem of our time, which we must turn into issue and trouble. Ultimately, the subject of his essay is the left and the problems plaguing the left as he understood them and as they manifested in the late 1950s. But to put it simply and in a way that relates to our current situation on the left, Mills is trying to address the problem of an ahistorical prescription to practice, which then turns this practice into an ahistorical and unspecific hope. There is a prevailing suspicion among the left that their political practice may not be adequate to transform or do away with the present impasse. Groups in the US that are driven by the compulsion of actionist politics often wonder about the precarious character of their gains. How are they to protect what they have won from the tide of right-wing reaction? It's unclear. Similarly, in our encounters with leftists here in Germany, there is a suspicion that work done for the purposes of theoretical clarity will not bring about or not spark a revolutionary movement. Often these groups that focus on theoretical work supplement their practice by building coalitions, participation in protest, and organizing demonstrations in response to the pressing necessity of current events, for example, North Africa or Greece. But it is in this case when immediate organizational practice is taken up to supplement theoretical clarification that one finds a curious formulation of the relationship between theory and practice. In this formulation, theoretical clarification functions in a sphere of analysis disparate, separate from the pressures of practical immediacy, even though this immediacy is recognized and thus cause for concern. But one type of practice is treated as if it is semi-autonomous from the other. This presentation is not by any means a call for the liquidation of theoretical work into immediate practice. It is rather meant to pose questions about the relationship between these two emphases in the self-conscious work of political organizations. The distance between the two is clearly in place. Theoretical work doesn't lead to clarity as to how to act politically in the world in order to transform it, and at the same time, activist political practice, as it currently exists, evades theoretical reflection in order to sustain its momentum, because thinking about its inefficacy would be too daunting of a prospect. Both forms of political practice are like torn halves which don't quite make a whole. To what extent can one claim an ongoing project of theoretical clarity without the ability to act on that clarity? And to what extent can one claim that one's actions are adequate or revolutionary without reflecting critically about their efficacy? The answer to this problem, then, is not one of emphasizing one type of practice over the other, but a question of their mediation. The fact that these two types of practices appear as mutually exclusive, that is, that it can appear that one must choose one or the other, or that these don't speak or don't affect each other, exemplifies the crisis in political praxis we hope to address with our work. I would like to return to a formulation by Mills, that of practice turning into an ahistorical and unspecific hope. The new left, while consciously rebelling against the failures of the old left, was unable to establish a more adequate political practice, and as the movement crumbled in the 1970s, it left behind unresolved problems, which, as I have tried to argue, are still with us today. Again, the biggest one of which is the relationship between theory and practice. Mills' work speaks to us today as a reminder that the impasse to historical transformation is not to be treated as a novel problem. If there's anything that the study of history of the left can provide, is how not to repeat the same mistakes. So what has the left been and what can it yet become? Platypus exists as a project because the answer to such a question, even its basic formulation, has long ceased to be self-evident. So we should open up for discussion and questions. I think that we wanted this to be the bulk of our event, even though our presentations were a bit long, but yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So any questions?
Questions? Disagreements, concerns? I'm sorry? The tobacco. I don't think we have any filters anymore. Really? No questions. Well, I mean, I guess we can ask you guys a question in terms of like our experience in Germany. We were trying to put our finger on the differences between the American left and the German left and the kind of dominant tendencies in each country. It seems like in the US left, there's an emphasis on activist practice. And so you go to the streets, you work, you know, you put up placards, and often this work doesn't really amount to transforming even the goals of that protest, right? So whether it be lower tuition or something like this. But that leftists continue to do this work and often suspend reflection. Because if you start thinking about how your practice is not transforming the world, then it will stop you from doing it. But in the German left, there seems to be a much more emphasis on theoretical clarity and the necessity to work through problems in theory. So this leaves one question for me unresolved, which is the way in which theoretical clarity work is supposed to affect or clarify your practice, what to do, how to transform the conditions under which you exist. But I want to know, I mean, you know, like, we want to know, like, what's your response to this? I mean, is this like a fair characterization, I guess, of something that is present in the German left? You know, if so, you know, if not, how not? Or if so, what is the point of agreement and this kind of thing? Maybe we're right on.
I don't know, just maybe to like loosen it up a little bit. Because like something that maybe didn't like come out in our presentation so well is like maybe we can like give you just like a quick background on how like this event like came into being. That was that in February of this year, or maybe going back to last year, we had a section of the Naturfund Jugend Berlin who visited the US and wanted to inform themselves about like the character of the American left. And so this is how we established context to Berlin. And so in February of this year, Pam and me, we started to plan a trip of Platypus members here to come to Germany to educate ourselves about the German left. So the last 3 weeks we spent in Berlin, and we met up with several different groups in Berlin, among them Top Berlin, the Friends of the Classes Society, Junge Linke,
Fels,
and Paris. So we tried to cover like some of like the main tendencies of the German left. And I mean, I'm from Germany, so I was like, to some extent, familiar with certain problems, but like it was interesting to see the interaction of or like the problems that were posed and how they differed from the problems that usually are present on the American left, which is much more shaped by activism, and so there's like a bigger discontent for theoretical clarity. So like when Platypus started, in that moment that we tried to lay out in like the 2006 moment of the anti-war protest, there was a big hesitation and a big resistance to engage in on any kind of reflection. And then, so this was like a major problem, and then in that sense it probably, it definitely shaped the way also Platypus came about as a praxis, as to have those different positions and to try to engage in a conversation. So then, here, when we presented in Berlin, for example, like the question came up of like to what extent there actually are discussions happening in Germany, like that there are like theoretical magazines like Phasen 2 and you know Jungle World and like also other newspapers in which discussion actually takes place or not. So, but then like the interesting part, and I guess like maybe you guys can like talk about this a little bit as well, like when we came here, the problem posed itself in a different way. That is that many of the groups were first and foremost interested in a theoretical clarification that dealt with, let's say, to a certain extent, abstract problems, or maybe concrete problems, but tried to struggle with it on like a level of analysis, and that it was not immediately apparent how that analytical moment of analyzing capital and the nation state actually impacts what the people do and how certain changes in analysis would actually impact any way how those groups operate.
Okay.
So in that sense, there was like a, you know, it was like, it's maybe on a level of appearance, it's a different problem, but what we would kind of try to get our, like, wrap our heads around is to what extent those two problems, the one of just acting in the world and the other one of not having like any ground of how to translate that like thought into action, actually speaks to a bigger problem that the left has, and not only in the various countries for itself, but actually speaks to a major problem that there is no adequate relationship between theory and praxis.
Can I see? I'm trying to figure out the character of the silence. Is the silence just like disagreement, confusion, or simply
over there.
A language barrier, okay.
We can translate.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention. So if there's hesitation to, like any question can be asked in German, and I'm happy to translate. So that should not be like the nature of like the hesitation. I'm sorry that I forgot to say this.
Also, any part of our presentations, like, unfortunately, don't speak German yet. So,
But there was one question.
Another question, more an answer to your question. I'm trying to shape my answer on my ear. Because I think the part where you said, probably in Germany, there's a lot about theory and abstract thoughts. That's pretty true. I mean, the whole discussion in Germany between the anti-German leftists and the anti-imperialist leftists, and then the different groups in the anti-imperialists, like the Trotskyists, like Ginsburg or whatever it is now, with Solid and so on. It is really abstract, and I mean, this shows you somehow why there is no transfer to from these abstract thoughts to a certain action. And I try to explain it a little bit. The concept of the Georg Büchner thingy that was like last year, was it last year? There was a concept of having a bumper car to blockade all the banks. Where there are different groups which came together, the anti-imperialists, anti-Germans also, anti-fascist groups, and they had also huge discussions, abstract and very quickly, is it good to blockade the banks, or is it like kind of anti-Semitic or whatever? Structural anti-Semitism, is it is it a wrong capitalism critique and so on? But the problem was that all these abstract thoughts actually didn't really grab the matter of the problem, that there were no groups who were actually engaging or doing it. As I had a friend over a few days ago who was in this group and organizing work for the leftist party, the Linkspartei, and she said there were no people that were actually engaged and helped, or not enough people, so the whole thing brought together and nothing came out of it. And the problem was that everybody's sitting there in this group and discussing about the abstract problems didn't even realize that there were no people and there was no chance that it was going to happen. And there was no concept where it was going to go. And I think this is like a huge problem, denying the situation and not regarding the situation which we're in.
Yeah, I mean, I maybe it's not the response so much, but like, there are groups like TOP that we spoke to in Berlin who have this kind of like two-pronged approach, or like a dual approach. And I think it's a recognition of this problem that you've just mentioned, meaning like they recognize that the work on theoretical clarity is important work. And so usually the older members will partake in this kind of work. And then the younger members are kind of like doing the black bloc action and this kind of like practical work. And, you know, and so they have a way of, there's an expression in English of squaring the circle. They have a way of like sort of solving the problem, saying, okay, we recognize that like not one thing is really doing what we wanted to do, not the other, so we do both. And so while I'm sympathetic to like the recognition of the problem, the question that remains though is that there seems to be a real distance between these two types of practices, right? Like going to a black bloc protest, because they say, we know that when we're going to the black bloc, you know, when we're doing an action like black bloc, et cetera, that, you know, we're not really talking to people about an analysis of capitalism. They recognize this, like, this is not, you know, like, we're not, like, handing out our, like, theoretical work in, like, our black bloc protest, right? But then we recognize that this work is really important. And so then what is the relationship between the two? The way in which they explained it was that it's really important for us to keep our presence in the scene, to, like, you know, be present, that people can see us, and to continue to exist in this way, so we do the protest. But in that sense, like, this practice is much more symbolic than anything. It's just a kind of, like, we stay alive because we want to be present, you know, we need to be present, right? But really, the really important work is like the theoretical work. And so, I mean, this just shows that there is this lack of mediation between the two of them that's sort of adequate. Like, if your theoretical work is important, it should somehow transform what you do in the world. And if your practice is important, it should somehow give you an insight to the way in which the present exists. It should affect your theoretical work, but that this doesn't happen. And so, yeah.
Well, there are similar stories from the U.S. In Wisconsin, for instance, there was a call by the Wobblies, the IWW, to have a massive strike, and of course it didn't happen. And the reason was in part a sort of misestimation of the strength. And this, but it also shows up in theory, that this misestimation isn't just a practical thing, but there it was sort of, oh look, people are again struggling for certain rights that they got through struggle, is a revival of the left. But then a few months later, and this movement just sort of has halted completely and was very unsuccessful in its attempt to change the situation. So misestimation, sort of denial of the facts, is everywhere.
Or, I mean, the other example is like in Wisconsin, around the time of the, at least what's now called the Arab Spring, and also in Wisconsin, which is a state in the U.S., there was massive protests, boycotts, strikes by factory workers, which people did turn out to, and many people got very excited, like, oh, this is, Wisconsin will be the Tahrir Square of the U.S., like, you know, like Cairo of the U.S. But, you know, it turned out that all of these were actually organized by the Democratic National Committee, which is, like, one of the two parties in the state, so, like, you know, it was like, you can also see how eager many leftists were to see any type of activity that completely jump onto it and give it a radical character, where in fact it was not, it was completely part of and orchestrated by mainstream political power. So.
But I would slightly disagree with that on the theoretical work doesn't affect the practice, because like the example is perfect, because I guess like 10 years ago it would be a whole lot of different, because if you haven't like discussions about, for example, structural anti-Semitism and the whole problem with false anti-capitalism, it would be different, because then, okay, no problem, banks are bad and the whole people, they have the money and blah, blah, blah. And so, of course, they would have done it. But now that, like maybe 10 years of, like, the influence of, like, the anti-German critique has even reached, like, groups like you met up, like, with anti-national groups mostly. And so even they say now that this is too difficult, that's not like the practice we can do, which is like correct and somehow. And so I think it does affect the practice.
Yeah, I mean,
in fact, it makes it even more complicated. But
Yeah, I mean, I would say that to that, I think you're right, but I think that there's the alternative practice that then is proposed. For example, they're doing like a float, like with music and this kind of thing. And Top was saying, like, oh, we really want to, like, project some movies on a float to, like, attract young people and this kind of thing. And you're sort of like, okay, I mean, I you know, obviously this is not a form of, like, anti-Semitic stance, but, like, what is it? What is it for? And so it does, I think, sort of go back to a deeper confusion as to what to do, as opposed to, like, reveal a better practice in the world.
Yeah, maybe I would say something, because it was like also like those discussions about concretistic form of, like, you know, anti-capitalism or fetishistic forms, and you know, mostly like in the discussions of like the anti-Deutsch, when they draw from, you know, the analysis of Moshe Piston to kind of flesh that out. I found, because when I wrote my presentation, I went back to Piston's text. It's called History and Helplessness. It was written in, I think, 2005 or something. And what struck me that actually what Piston made is that, like, he not only, I mean, he fleshed out this, like, misrecognition very well, but what he also made clear is that those misrecognitions were bound up in the inability of the left to change the world. So he has this whole section where he discusses certain forms of violence and how like a certain violence emerged in the, let's say, the 70s, and but then was carried on, and let's say in the support of like various resistance movements, and how this like this turn to violence itself expressed an inability to grapple with the world, and thus that it was not only like complications in theory or like misconceptions in theory that like sprung up and that just need to be solved by like a better theory that could provide like a better analysis, but that those concretistic issues are themselves related to the present character of the left, to its inability to actually have any change. So in that, like facing those conditions, like for me the question really was, to what extent was the anti-Deutsch critique able, like to what extent did it really address the very problem itself? And that would be, I think, that like the anti-Deutsch critique, by like critiquing those forms of misrecognition, would have to better grapple with the problem of this impasse of the left today. And I think it simply didn't do that. It like remained in like polemical stances, it remained in like, you know, like politics, like to split different movements because like they had the wrong analysis. And something that like I would still say I was like to a certain extent sympathetic with is that like that form of critique, at least it pointed out that the left today become an obstacle to any emancipatory change. But I think they didn't like really have like any concept in place, or they didn't like really like struggle for actually changing that impossibility. So instead of like fleshing out, and this is like why in my presentation I took in Leszek Kolakowski, where he discusses what the concept of the left is. That, for example, this didn't take place here. So it was like the response was, if the left is like just a bunch of crap in the present, we just need to like leave the left behind, we need to break it. But there was no reflection on how actually the left at some point in time actually uphold certain certain utopian ideas that it wanted to put forth. And thus I would say like a more like adequate response to that problem would be actually to struggle with that problem. How can the left actually become left in a more meaningful way? And that it isn't in the present, that this actually presents a problem that we have to like struggle through and not merely succumb to it. Because I would say like the responses that, and like the praxis of just like merely going in and like breaking up movements and, you know, and like polemicizing against them, actually they couldn't reflect on that. They just like succumbed to the situation. It wasn't like really struggling with it in order to like change it. And this is, I think, like something that up to today is in a way missing, like a politics that actually addresses this inability of the left. And what does it mean today for the left that it actually doesn't have any impact? And I think so. This is like, and this is why initially I became attracted to like this kind of problem, because to our project, to Platypus. I was in the States in 2008, where I came across this group, and I found it to deal with this problem in a more meaningful way, in terms of like putting it on the table that actually this is the problem of the left today, and that we don't have like ready-made answers for this, but this is something that one needs to think through, that like this inability to have any impact is something that the left has to take into account. And should not just like continue doing what it always did, because that like can't explain why like it was like regressing and collapsing. And so one would need to like tackle that problem of like how does one deal with the problem that the left today is ineffective.
I have 2 points. The first is on the stated difference between the German and the American left. And I think maybe also from the groups you met, you have a certain tendency to overemphasize the sort of the impact of the anti-Deutsch people or theory in Germany. Because one point I found interesting was the opening in Heiligendamm in 2007, and there it seemed that all these kind of debates evaporate, because even groups that were sympathetic to theoretical discussions went to these kind of protests and said, okay, although we don't really, or at least that was my impression, although we don't really know why we're going there, although we know that these eight guys in that room don't decide or are sort of more a representation of what is happening today and not the real power mongers or whatever, yeah, they still went there. And it seemed that all these debates kind of evaporated. That's the one thing. And I have the feeling that these kind of debates, you have to go over them over and over again. If you, for example, I was organizing anti-Nazi protests in Mainz across the Rhine in 2009, and we had the same problem that people, yeah, they didn't get why Nazis, well, of course Nazis were a problem, but sort of the people demonstrating against Nazism in itself too, because they sort of formed a new form of, let's say, post, or the German, the thing you call the Berliner Republik, which has in itself the idea that we're beyond Nazism, and that now Germans should stand up against, or that a good German is not a Nazi, but somebody who stands up against Nazism. So that this whole anti-fascism was somehow integrated into the German, the new German ideology, so to speak. That's one thing, and the other one is that I think the sort of the idea, or the idea of the anti-Deutsche Kritik in a way is that theory in itself, or theorizing in itself, is sort of the only form of, is in itself a form of political praxis, and it's one of the only meaningful forms of praxis left, because all the others would be a kind of repetition. And I think that, of course, it has somehow gotten out of hand, or this whole polemical stance doesn't serve the purpose anymore, but I think that sort of the intervention into leftist groups in a polemical way to say, okay, we kind of get what you're aiming at, but this is not the right way, because, yeah, there is this kind of impasse, and you can't just go over it and just pretending it's not there. This is actually sort of one of the only ways to be active today, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it leaves us, because I want to also say something that we take rather seriously. I mean, Platypus doesn't really offer answers to this problem, and we say that we're a pre-political project to some extent, meaning that we don't have sort of political positions that we can say, okay, well, now you should so follow this line, because, you know, we uphold a better sort of revolutionary legacy. But that leaves us also in a tricky sort of like position. Really, our practice is driven by, like Jerzy has tried to explain, by putting this problem on the table in order for leftists and those who are interested in politics can recognize it as maybe the problem of our moment, the problem of our time. But it does have a pre-political quality to it, because in a sense you're raising problems for recognition that can't be overcome by that conversation. Like the problem of political impasse in the present can't simply be overcome in terms of a discussion about it. But often we use, for better or for worse, we use like a psychoanalytic sort of analogies in terms of like thinking about a patient with a particular problem, let's say, who doesn't recognize the nature of the pathology. And the first step in therapy usually is to, and again, this is an analogy, right? It's not meant to sort of adequately describe this, but that the first part of the way in which one gets better and the potential for like recognizing it is to think about it as a problem, to sort of say, okay, this may be something that I want to transform in myself, and what are the means through which I can transform it so that I don't end up neurotically repeating the same thing and feeling like I have no control over it. It's a gamble, I would say, like what we're trying to do. But what I think keeps us going is that every time that we get established in a new place, there seem to be also sympathetic people who recognize in their own political practice that, you know, there seems to be a block to actually transforming the situation. And so, I mean, our organization is constituted by individuals who also have felt this in their own attempts to be political. I know that we gave you a little history of the group in terms of 2006 and the anti-war movement. I think it's rather important for us because when we were out there basically talking to leftists, they were like, look, like you have to recognize the urgency of the present. You have to recognize that like there's a war going on. So you have to take a position. You have to basically be against one force or the other. You have to take the right position. But what if there isn't a right position to take? And what if one wants to have a dual critique? One wants to say like, okay, these forces that you're supporting are actually of the right, but so is like American policy, right? And so it's not like we want to capitulate to one to the other, but we want to create the space, the time to be able to develop a left that can adequately deal with that impasse. Which is what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of the like groups that organized cover groups, I guess you could say that
front groups.
Yeah, that's the term for it. Front groups like the World Can't Wait, for example, organized by RCP.
Yeah, Revolutionary Communist Party.
And Maoist Party in the States, quite large. So like really insisting on this like moment of like urgency and gathering like many, many people in the process through this feeling of immediacy.
Their logo was the world on fire.
Yeah, it was blowing up.
So it was like, you know,
like
take,
yeah.
Join
and,
us.
In this case, like, it's funny, like, I mean, we really seemed as if, to them, we seemed as if we were, like, overly contemplative, overly theoretical. And, you know, like, we had to sort of make recourse also to, like, kind of, the history of 68 in a way, like where some, like, you know, for example, if we were looking at the debate between Adorno and Marcuse around the support for the student movement, you know, like understanding why Adorno would withhold support for this kind of spontaneous uprising that happened around the world but then also subsequently collapsed, just as the anti-war movement in the US subsequently collapsed almost immediately. So, I mean, I think that this is like the importance of reintroducing also kind of historical reflection as a part of like theoretical practice, which I say we would also find, also as, like you were saying, I would agree, like it is essential form of practice, which it's funny we don't quite have to defend as much here, but you know, like the anti-intellectualism is like so rampant.
Mm-hmm.
In the States and everywhere, actually. I'm sure it is here as well. So.
I'd just like to address your point about the GA. I mean, the fact that these groups are going there not as, like, openly saying, all right, we're going here just to, like, meet people and expand our groups, kind of recruit, that is, or we're going there because we support the motives of these protests, but rather we don't know why we're going, is itself an indication that the relation between theory and practice has broken down. These groups are aware that their practice and their theory are sort of disconnected, but they just didn't really, you know, if what you're saying is right, they just didn't seem to be addressing it.
And also, because I find that into, like, the second point you raised about, like, you know, certain, and I mean, this would probably not apply only to, like, anti-Deutsch groups or, like, certain tendencies on the left that, you know, get, like, evacuated in theory. But it would also apply, you know, let's say, to the academic left, to academic Marxism, and to, like, various branches. And I think, you know, like, what's interesting about it is that, like, at least, like, it raises a certain problem of theory and praxis. Like, that, you know, the anti-Deutsch saying, okay, you have to stop going to protests and do, like, silly stuff, but, like, you really have to understand the world. And this is, like, praxis as well. On the one hand, you know, on the one hand, it's interesting because it tries to, like, actually address, like, a kind of distorted relationship between, like, let's say, practicism or, like, activism. On the other hand, I would say that, like, what's, like, deeply confused about it, that it doesn't really try to work through the problem that's present, but it just, like, readily and, like, willingly just takes it out of, like, any form of having any impact. So, like, what, like, many groups, and I remember, like the group I was a part of, like, back in the day. So we would have, like, those, like, let's say, you know, like, discussions, right? We would, like, invite people we agree with anyway, that, like, people read anyway, and just, like, to have, like, a talk so that, like, people could educate themselves, like, a little bit better. So this, like, really begs the question, to what extent, you know, to what extent does that impact anything? Like, to what extent does that, like, because, again, like, I think, you know, it would be very important to add, to address, like, the like kind of inability, or like in a way like even like a certain idiocy that's going on in like protest politics, to go out for like any kind of cause, and then, you know, with the maybe like the biggest hope that one could achieve, that you know, a lot of people will come out, and that maybe the like local papers, or like even like, you know, you make it on like national television, and then you had an impact, right? Then you can celebrate and point people to, okay, listen, you know, like people talked about it, right? As like raising some kind of discourse. But so in one way, like I think, you know, it would be like important to see like the problematics of that, right? To like address like certain problematic forms of that. But then like the flip side of this, and like it doesn't really like struggle with the problem, I would say, that it just like evacuates itself in like theory, and it at best like tries to maybe, you know, like talk to the people that are in there anyway, and maybe to get like a few new people, if at all. But I think what would be important is that like actually theory in a way like can be conceived as praxis, but not like in itself. I think it's really about like the relationship, the questions that theory raises. I mean, like for example, like we in Platypus, we like do not like organize like any street protests or anything. We don't think that at our, not because like we're against or like principally opposed to it. But we think, like, you know, back then, like, let's say, like, you know, 100 years ago, when there was a protest going on, right? Like, that was, like, had its self-conception of, like, a kind of, like, showing of strength. And when, I don't know, like, 1,500 or, like, 2 million workers would go out on the street, that was, like, indeed a show of strength. That indeed had an impact. That indeed could, like, shape certain politics that were debated, right? Like, you could have, you know, and it would be the question now with, like, the crisis of Greece, right? Like, to what extent, like, a successful protest, let's say, you know, like, the, or, like, let's say, a big strike in, like, German factories could actually affect foreign policy towards Greece. But obviously, we don't have that. We're not in this moment. We don't have that kind of force. We don't have that kind of strength.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, like, it begs the question, like, how can we have an impact on the world? And to what extent? So, like, what we try to do in Platypus by like hosting fora and also publishing them in like in the paper you can find over there. I mean, this is not supposed as just like some practice, just like that, like kind of stays confined. Like, we try to actually reach out to the left, to its various branches, and to like engage with them. And we hope by engaging them in a critical manner, that we provide questions that would help them to like self-reflect on their praxis.
And one thing, like, there was a huge protest, I think it was 2007, on the immigration protests in Chicago.
Yeah.
Seven. It's massive protests in Chicago, unlike what Chicago has seen. Seven? Or anyway, it was
more recent. I think it was 10.
No, because I was gone already, and I was part of the protest, so I was already in New York.
I think we're thinking of two different ones. There were
okay. Well, there was one principal one in the last decade that was pretty impressive. I mean, as far as like turnout, like protests in the U.S. are rather small usually, and you know, you can see like the sectarian groups sort of like coming out with their like 20 people or something. But this protest was massive. Like, entire businesses were shut down as a result of it, and you know, basically people were called on, if you're an immigrant, don't go to work today. And it happened. I mean, meaning like people went out into the streets. But what you saw was, you know, a kind of like, you kind of, it was like the palpable ideological confusion. People went out there with like, let's say, flags of their countries, like, you know, the Mexican flags, Puerto Rican flags, Cuban flags, etc. And then at the very end of the protest, which ended in Grand Park in Chicago, there was like absolutely no speeches. No one spoke. And everyone felt like, all right, you know, it's great. And sort of like went and like did this. And we were trying to wrap our heads around this because we recognized that some people were even organized on the basis of like race, meaning like the way in which, you know, labor organizers were presenting the necessity to come out to this protest was on the basis of like racial solidarity, that you stand with your like brown brother, or, like brown sister, and like you go out there and support, you know, like your people or whatever. And so we had an event like on this issue, on like sort of anti-immigration policies and how to respond to these problems. And we invited people who were like labor organizers or community organizers, and we wanted them to like answer questions about their practice. Okay, so, and it's not that these people didn't recognize the problem. You know, that's like the key part, is that like these, for example, I'm thinking of one person who, Jorge Mujica, who was like a community organizer, who was like, listen, the question is that we want to organize people. We want to get them out into the streets. We want them to become politicized, right? But the way in which people think about why they need to go out there is in terms of like supporting their brown brothers and sisters. So that's the only way in which I can get them out there, right? Like you, I can like bring people to the streets insofar as I tell them, okay, you know, like just come out and we'll think about these problems later. But of course they know in their own sort of like self-consciousness and recognition that any labor movement that's worth its salt would need to actually have cross-racial like organizing. Like you can't actually promote like racism within the labor movement. It's just a recipe for disaster. But they were like, well, we're in a moment in which, you know, a lot of the working class is right wing. So how do we get people out there if not by like conceding to what they think? And so, and he recognized that if he were to have a conversation with this person about like the necessity to overcome these like racial biases, that he may not get them out there, right? And it was sort of like, okay, but this is like a complicated problem. Like you recognize the necessity to organize workers, but on what basis? And like, how is it that what you're doing actually transforms that situation that you yourself recognize as a problem, as like an obstacle to actually organizing workers, and moreover, in the long run, to organizing like a labor movement. Like, and so it's, you know, it's a complicated issue, and it's not something that, I mean, again, the panel that we had this at the kind of core, you know, at the center, and this is why we invited labor organizers and like grassroots organizers, people that are engaged with these politics on a day-to-day basis, that know that these obstacles are out there, but are unclear how like to change their practice in the present and how that would make a difference. So, I mean, it's something that like, because Rob, one of our contacts in Berlin who distributes the PR there, when we were talking to him and we were like, okay, so we have this, you know, this kind of statement of like the left is dead. And he said, well, Pam, do you really think that the left doesn't know that it's dead? And I was like, you know, actually, I think a lot of people do recognize that the left is dead. Is the problem is that no one's really saying it, and no one is really thinking about how it should affect what they do. And that's actually a deeper issue, right? Because it's even like, you know, to not know that like this is happening to you is one thing, but to like know and to not act on it, to not to be transformed by it, perhaps is a deeper type of problem, right? Like Jorge Mujica understood that this was going to be a problem for any future of a labor movement, but he didn't feel himself that he had the power to transform it. And there was sort of like this disconnect between what he understood as being right and the necessities of the present.
I can imagine it's not so different. I mean, a totally different context, but I mean, like if the German government also takes up the ideology of anti-fascism, and incorporates it into national policy, and then people continue to persist to organize on the basis of Antifa and suppressing emergency fascism, like, you know, there's a serious question that needs to be answered or that's being begged to be addressed, but oftentimes, you know, at least from my experience, it seems like that essential question, like out of fear for eliminating the basis for the politics that you've produced, won't be asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, this is where this leaves us. I mean, there's like the practice that we do in terms of like hosting fora or putting publication together that invites people who are on the left today to basically answer questions about how their practice is adequate to their goals is meant to start up a discussion in which this problem is seen at the center of leftist politics today. And that's really, I mean, in a kind of pithy way, that's what we try to do as an organization, which is why whenever we go to these different cities, we make it a point to meet as many people as possible, as many people who consider themselves to be on the left, to better understand how this problem manifests. And, you know, it's something that, like Jerzy leading the chapter efforts here in Frankfurt, this discussion as to how to grapple with these problems in Germany is only going to come to clarity, so insofar as there's an ongoing conversation as to what kind of events to host in Frankfurt and Berlin. And so, I mean, this is kind of like an invitation, basically, to the people who are here and who may find sort of at least sympathetic recognition that this is a problem in any way.
Sense, like what we what you start doing here in Frankfurt is to, you know, to kind of figure out what like present problems they are, and also like problems that also came about historically, and to try to grapple with them. So like in the, we hope like in the future semester and in the next semesters that we can have like panel discussions which are, you know, more like in the spirit of what we usually do. So in terms of like inviting people from different from different parts of the left, from different tendencies, to actually pose those questions, to actually like try to have that like recognition of a problem, and to in order for starting those conversations, how to grapple with them. So in that sense, that's like that's going to be an ongoing effort that we hope to establish also here in Frankfurt.
Good. I think we're going to get a beer maybe after this, so it's
like
a little bit more informal if you want to join us to have like a more kind of ongoing conversation over liquor, which all makes everything easy.
Thank you for coming.
Yes,
on.
Thank you for coming. Thanks. Do you have the sign-up sheet?
Oh yeah. Also, yeah. If you guys want to stay informed, what's happening here in Frankfurt, and also like.